So it's just the idea there's order and there's chaos, but they work together. That's sort of how a democracy works. So that's kind of like what I talk about.
But at the end of the day, it is the people that live in these places that were trying to create something that they actually like, something they want to use and enjoy, and something they're going to look at in 50 years, 100 years, and be like, that's a great building or bridge or something else.
Welcome to the Community Center for Marengo Urbanism, a show about bringing people together to build a better future for us all. I'm Kyler. I'll be your host for today. I'm an architect and design communicator based out of Oklahoma City. Today, we'll actually be joined by two very special guests. You'll meet one of them now and one of them later, but together, they will be helping us answer the question, how can a radically untraditional approach to architectural design lead to better cities for everyone? Riley Tour, welcome to the show. Could you start us out by telling us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and how we know each other?
I am Riley Tour. I work for an architecture firm in Dallas, Texas. I'm from around Dallas, so I've been here most of my life. And then me and Kyler went to college together at the University of Oklahoma. So that's how we know each other. Digging in the trenches for 5 years. So yeah.
Yep, pretty much. So recently, I had the opportunity to actually interview an architect based out of San Francisco that our professors told us a lot about throughout school. His name's Donald McDonald. He's probably most famous for his bridges. He designed the eastern span of the Oakland Bay Bridge in San Francisco, which is probably like the second most notable bridge in San Francisco. I had the opportunity to interview him about a week and a half ago. And I wanted to discuss with you, Riley, the questions I asked him, the answers he gave me, and we could just kind of provide additional context and chat about what he said. So without further ado, if you're ready to get started, I can dive into the first one.
Yep, let's get going on this one.
First of all, welcome to the show. Could you start us out by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I'm an architect. I've done about 500 buildings, building projects, I should say. About 70 bridges and just about 100 pieces of do-it-yourself furniture, plus a lot of other ball stuff. Done 7 books, so it's been a very interesting career, but the basis of it started in Oklahoma. I was able to carry it through to my practice today. So I graduated from Oklahoma University of Oklahoma many years ago, and I came in there just after Bruce Goff had resigned, and I was really influenced by Herb Green. I graduated before he left, and then he left and went to the University of Kentucky. At that time, I felt Oklahoma had lost some kind of, intuitive development that was going on, and it was quite unique at Oklahoma, and that's one of the reasons I went there. I was interested in the creative process, and I think that I wanted to work with intuition and things like that, and Oklahoma seemed to be the place to go. And as you probably know, I grew up in Canada, and I was going to go to the University of Manitoba. Then I saw some work that Goff had done because I was working with an architect at the time up there just out of high school. And I feel that guy's really scratching the creative process and he's teaching undergraduate, so I figured that's where to go. When I got there, he had left, so I ended up with Herb Green. But Herb had such a good feeling working with intuition. I use that term. I don't know if he'd use it, but understanding the creative process, you know, what turns on the light bulb, what's unique, what can you do that solves a problem? And so Oklahoma really offered that for me when I was there. And I've used it throughout my career, from designing furniture to bridges and buildings. And
what was your knowledge of Donald McDonald when I mentioned this to you? Like, what came to mind?
You know, I had remembered the name, but I honestly could not remember what I don't know. I feel like I just couldn't remember who he was specifically. So I did, obviously, I looked him up right away and I just saw a bunch of bridges. And so I thought, okay, yeah, I know who this guy is. I know a little bit of what he's done. And then he kind of shared that book that he had written, Democratic Architecture, read a little bit of it before this. And so I kind of have an idea of what he's all about.
A little backstory. I reached out to our former professor, Stephanie Pilot, and I was going to interview her, but she said, no, you should interview Donald McDonald. You should reach out to him. And I was like, okay, I guess I'm doing that. And when he did call me back after emailing him, I got to it. I read his book over the weekend, Democratic Architecture. As he said, he wrote like 7 different books. He has one on the Golden Gate Bridge and Alcatraz. So lots of interesting topics if you're interested in, you know, San Francisco especially. But Democratic Architecture specifically really hits on how the approach that he learned at OU, which we're going to talk a little bit more about here in a minute, intersects with this sort of urbanism and city development type of thing that, you know, you and I are all about. We've talked about these things. I think you actually introduced me to Not Just Bikes all the way back in the, you know,
yes,
however long ago that was. But yeah, he's a really interesting guy with a really interesting career. But it started out at OU, which I think is interesting. And that's also why our professors talked about him so much.
Yes.
I've heard that you coined the term American school to refer to Goff and Green's sort of teaching style. How would you describe their philosophy on architecture and how it differed from others at the time?
Well, the thing is that, like, if you'd gone to Harvard, you got Gropius, who was bringing the Bauhaus to America. You'd gone to the middle of America, you had Mies van der Rohe's school up at University of Illinois. Then on the West Coast, you had a lot of influence from Asia on the architecture. And there's different architecture, Maybeck and people like that. So when you're in Oklahoma, you're not under those kind of influences. And so it gives you a chance to develop as an individual. And I've always felt it's very important to develop as an individual and not be part of a school. And that's sort of what I got at Oklahoma. I did a show in London at the Royal Institute of British Architects. And at that time, I coined the phrase the American School of Architecture. It was a big show in London, and we had the American ambassador come and open the show up. It was just quite a success, and I showed work of all the Oklahoma graduates on the West Coast and a few other people who were kind of in that vein of teaching or the pedagogical aspects that I had experienced. And it was carried on. It went into Japanese magazines. It was picked up. Japan was picked up in Italy. In other words, it had resonance throughout the world, basically, a way of thinking. And the American school isn't a style of architecture. It's just a way of thinking. It's solving a problem. Like, give you an example. If you have a project and the client wants a Victorian, then you work with them to get a Victorian. If he wants a design that's really far out and unique, then you give him that. You know, in other words, you work with your client and you don't work with the philosophy of the East or West Coast, which was prevalent at the time I was in school. And Hans Butzer, who's a really good dean at Oklahoma now, really picked it up and really understood the significance of it. And I was always amazed that after I did the show in London, and I had these two publications, Architecture and Urbanism, out of Japan that picked it up, but nobody picked it up in Oklahoma. It was kind of a sad thing because it was so unique and so original. It was really great. But anyhow, Hans came along. And I went to Oklahoma before he was dean. I gave a lecture on marketing and how important it was in branding ideas and that. So, and I guess he was in the audience that picked it up. But he ended up, you know, copywriting the name, which was a really important thing to do. And it gave Oklahoma a real sort of place in the nation, in my mind, as far as a place to come for original thinking and working with intuition and things like that.
Hans has actually described Donald McDonald as one of the most impactful graduates in the history of the OU architecture program. I'm curious what your takeaway from school about the American school was, like how you felt they taught about that history and what, you know, what that history was all about.
You know, going into architecture school, one, I don't feel like I come from a very creative background or family very much. I kind of had to force my way into that. My dad's in sales and I don't want to do that. I felt that was really boring. And so I somehow ended up in architecture just because, you know, I wasn't good enough at math to do engineering and I wasn't very good at drawing. So I ended up not going into like any artsy kind of stuff. So architecture was it because I liked building things. So that's just to say, I didn't really know much about architecture going into it. I thought maybe, you know, it was like houses and like all that stuff. And, you know, growing up in the suburbs, you kind of see the type of things that are out there, which aren't very impactful to you, doesn't really inspire a sense of
anything, really. It's all pretty much the same thing. So that's kind of what I was sort of expecting architecture to be. I had kind of gone out to Dallas proper a few times growing up, not too much. I don't know. My parents never brought us out here that often. But I think whenever I first really started discovering what architecture was and what it could be was the summer before going off to college, because I was like, you know, I'm going to school for this stuff. I gotta do some research. I gotta figure out what I'm getting myself into here. I don't know how other schools are at all, even after graduating. I know a little bit of, I've seen what other schools, what their students kind of produce and all that. But going to OU, it was really hammering into us the idea of the American school, you know. Brought us out to Tulsa one time to go look at some of Bruce Goff's work, the Prairie Chicken House by Herb Green, all this stuff. It feels hammered into us, but I think it's less of the projects and the people that they're trying to get to us. It is kind of what McDonald's trying to get at. It's the execution of the work. It's how you go about things. I mean, this isn't like a commercial for OU School of Architecture. But I don't feel like there was a professor there that was really kind of hammering a certain specific style or way of thinking into you. Everyone was definitely trying to pull out the creativity that was in you to try and get the best that you could do. And it really forced you to figure out what way of working works for you the best, which I think was really nice.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
How did your American school education teach you to strike a balance between experimentation of form and also meeting the programmatic and functional requirements that are specified by the client?
Well, the thing is that there's certain things you can work with. You can work with how the sun works on the project and how the weather works. Like here in San Francisco, in the seismic zones. In other words, there's so many things outside the client's desires that have to be resolved. And then you deal with his desires. And so that's kind of the way it works. And you might look at other solutions. How do you hang a house on the side of a hill? And you want to make sure you're on serpentine shale like San Francisco, or you're on the sand, and that means something different below. But a lot of things come into play. There's things coming into play now like fire. In other words, if you look in Los Angeles, all the damage is done to that big fire a couple of weeks ago. You know, now you got to start thinking about, how do you protect houses with fire and from fire and make them fire resistant? And I've done a couple of houses that are in fire zones, and we put fireproof materials all over the building so that they can survive the fire. And we're trying to have the owner keep the bush down around the house. There's just a lot of things that are playing now. The hurricanes are getting stronger. There are more tornadoes, as you know, in Oklahoma. How do you create projects in the rising tides? And just there's so many things that have to be resolved. And then you deal with the client's desires from once you take that stuff into play.
One of the quotes from the book Democratic Architecture that I thought was really fascinating was, if one design characteristic can be said to be most expressive of democracy, it is fragmentation. And then he went on to argue that architects should actually strive for disharmony, contradiction, flux, and disparity in their designs rather than orderliness and consistency. But he also clarified, this does not mean disorder and originality for their own sake. Its purpose is to satisfy the functional and aesthetic needs of the people who inhabit buildings, not to be a realization of the architect's subjective impulses. I guess what he was trying to explain was that we shouldn't just make everything homogenous. In fact, we should specifically try not to do that, because that's more representative of the people who actually use the buildings, right? Not everybody is the same. Not every client is the same. And it doesn't make sense for every building to be the same. I do think another thing that was talked about a lot in school, and I know you have opinions on this, is the sort of idea of the starchitect with a very distinctive style of architecture. And they could plop down, you know, one of their signature buildings in any city in the world. But that doesn't really represent the city unless that architect is actually working with the community and implementing the needs and desires of that community.
Right. Now, I mean, it's the idea of, you know, form follows function. You know, the building's got to be functional first and the beauty follows after that. Like you said, someone might come to one of these architects and say, hey, you know, I love your work on this, blah, blah, blah. I want you to plop this right in the middle of some city in North Dakota. I don't know. Think of the Guggenheim in North Dakota.
And it just doesn't work because the Google Map doesn't work in
hot but, take alert.
You know, it's just it doesn't work for the place that's being built for. It doesn't work for the context. I mean, it's just function is how we design first and foremost, and how that influences the form. I mean, that all comes as you're kind of figuring this stuff out. It's not all just a one solution fits all. It's not a piece of IKEA furniture that you can just put together and place in your corner of the apartment or house, whichever you have.
Yeah, for sure.
So how would you say that architects can contribute to a more humane society? And what does it mean for a design to be rooted in the variety of human experience?
I think on that means is there again, I'll go back to the client. You know, the client's a human being, and what are his desires and how do you make him achieve them? And if you can do it with a third dimension, which, like, let me give you an example. If I was doing a house for an engineer, I'd make sure that he can understand, looking at the ceiling, how the structure works for the engineer, so he's comfortable in his house, how they work in earthquakes. You know, in other words, you take the client's desires or the client's needs or how he wants to live. I did a ranch out in a place called Bolinas, and the client wanted a barn-like structure. So I did a design for him that was related to that, but it was also on an earthquake fault, and that it created other elements in the design. And so I had to fireproof the buildings, and he wanted to be off the grid, so we have to develop a situation and get water, clean water, and solar power. So a lot of those things come into play. You know, that's sort of an example. I don't know if that's exactly what you're looking for, but that's kind of the way I think about it.
One of these things that I've noticed recently is that a lot of people online are talking about how, and I don't know if you've seen this, but how we used to build beautiful buildings, but we don't anymore.
Yeah.
And usually what they mean by that is like classically styled traditional architecture buildings. And actually in the book, in Democratic Architecture, he brings up a quote from Philip Johnson that is that the job of an architect is to create beautiful buildings. That is all.
Wasn't Philip Johnson also a Nazi?
That was what I was about to bring up.
That's what I'm kind of going to bring up with that, because I have some very opinions about people online saying that, you know, cities don't build beautiful buildings anymore. Yeah, I get where it's coming from. I agree that buildings is like everything. It's, you know, it's for profit. At the end of the day, someone's trying to make money. Whoever's building it, developer, whatever, they got to make money somehow. And so if that means that they've got to do a cut and paste type thing to save some money, or they've got to get rid of some ornamentation or something, you know, it's going to happen. We don't want it to happen as designers, but it's just the reality of it all that it just happens. It's capitalism.
So the reason he even brought up that quote from Philip Johnson, notable Nazi, is that he was refuting it, basically, to say that architects actually have this responsibility to build humane structures, and that no building is necessarily neutral, and they're not just there for decoration. They're there to be used.
Right. And I think, you know, a building could be beautiful as much as it wants, but if it doesn't function properly, then, you know, what's the point? Look at any of the Corbusier's buildings. There is a lot of stuff talked about where the owners of those buildings after it's built are like, God, this building sucks. Like, it leaks. It doesn't work properly. Like, I just don't like this house. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Philip Johnson did the glass house, right?
Yeah.
They could not live in that building. It was a beautiful building, but God, like, imagine living in a building where it's all glass. There's no privacy whatsoever. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So, you know, function is first and foremost, like, the thing for anything that's built.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing he hinted at here that I think a lot of people don't realize is that there's so many other invisible aspects to architecture, like the systems. If you want to be off grid, you have, you know, a septic system that's completely invisible. I mean, obviously, if you live there, you're going to be dealing with that on a regular basis. But if you just see the building, you're not thinking about that. But those are the types of things that you have to spend money on nowadays that, you know, back in the day, you just had an outhouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In your book, Democratic Architecture, you talked a lot about adaptable villages, possibly composed of studio homes or other things like that. How would you say these types of adaptable, changeable over time villages can strengthen familial and community ties for those who inhabit them?
Now, what I've done is that I'll give you an example. Like in the United States, we have shopping centers, right? We have these big parking lots around a shopping center. There's no reason why we can't platform those parking lots and put housing on top, and then you have a complete village. And what you want to do is cut down commuting time. You'd like people to work near where they live. And so when I do these, what I call two worlds, I've done about five of them now. They're city blocks. Some of them go up to three city blocks. You can actually live and work in that complex. You don't have to get in the car and drive half an hour to the office. So I always push those ideas. And again, I'm going to repeat it, but the main thing is you take a shopping center and you platform the parking areas and you put housing on top and you've got a complete village. And so that's kind of in essence what I've been doing. And I've done a bunch of them and they really work. And there's ways to do it economically. In other words, in most of them, you have to have it so that the housing, if they're sold off in the free market, that covers all the costs and profits. And then 20% of the space is into commercial use, and that is sort of on its own. So you don't go any more than 20%, then that means it can carry itself just with the housing. So there's things like that that I've learned. In fact, the Urban Land Institute in Washington, D.C. did a big issue on my two world type projects, did a publication on it. So it's kind of interesting that most architects don't think in those terms.
One of the things that I was getting at with this question is in the book, he proposes these studio homes, which are very similar to what today we would call it just a tiny house. They're like a studio apartment as a freestanding structure. His has like a lofted bed over the sort of kitchen living area. So it kind of compartmentalizes the space, but it's all about getting rid of anything that's not absolutely necessary in order to build the most affordable type of unit. And then he goes on to say, well, then if you build a whole village of these and you expand them over time and they grow up slowly, then you kind of build this community incrementally and organically. And I was kind of interested to talk to you about that concept, because our last semester together, you had done a project where you're proposing this sort of modular system of housing that could grow and change over time with community. And I was interested to hear your take on that.
Well, I think the big thing that I was kind of hitting on that project and what McDonald's kind of hitting at there with those studio homes like that is that we kind of have whole communities just pop up overnight nowadays. And, you know, nothing is vernacular. Nothing takes time and grows organically to the needs of the community. Like, you know, the more housing you need, okay, build a few more things. Oh, we need a grocery store, you know, put that in somewhere. We need more space for people to work or for businesses to open up, build that over there. But nowadays it's like cities are just investing in the concept that people want to live in these places, and then eventually they don't, and these places just sit in purgatory forever and just end up burning down. I think it's interesting, the strange phenomenon of billionaires wanting to create like cities in the desert for some reason. Like, that is so strange. And, you know, they've got these whole communities like planned out and everything. None of it's organic. Nobody's asked for this. They've just suddenly been like, hey, let's build this utopia out in the desert for rich people.
Yeah. And those projects always fail because they're not representative of the people.
No, it's not representative of anybody that will live there other than the ultra rich. You know, you'll have people living in whatever these crazy homes are they want to build, and then you'll have the working class kind of, I don't mean this to be like a rise up people type thing. I'm just saying, like, you got to think about it. Like, where, you know, all these people that are working, you know, where are they going to live? Are they going to have to commute it in? Are they going to build like these weird like slums on the outskirts? It's just a strange concept that doesn't really have any thinking in reality.
I think that's a good transition into the next question here.
I was going to ask actually more about two worlds, because I really enjoyed the chapter where you talked about that in your book. And you started that chapter by talking about Seaside, Florida, in what I would describe as like a scathing review. So I'm curious what you think places like Seaside, Florida are lacking and what they're getting wrong. when it comes to building community.
I mean, to me, it's not wrong or right. It's what some people want. Like some people want Catholic sort of spaces. You know, they want to, it's like the Catholic Church has a whole program on how they like space, you know. Whereas if you do something like a synagogue for the Jews, they reinterpret the Bible all the time, or the Talmud, whatever it is. What I'm getting at is every different groups have different needs. So you have to study this. If you want to do a building for the church, you have to realize what the philosophy is and you deliver that church if you want. If you don't, you don't do it. So it's just the idea there's order and there's chaos, but they work together. That's sort of how a democracy works. So that's kind of like what I talk about. But like two worlds came about because there's a lot of heritage trees in the site, and I could wander around the site with forms and things like that. And to do that, I left the grid. And I also had to appeal to the city because they had zoning on one side for housing and the other side for commercial, and I was mixing them up. So again, it was a prototype, but the idea was to make it so that people could live and work in the same space, and many of them do now, which is quite interesting.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was when he talked about two worlds in the book, he started it off with talking about Seaside, Florida, which is a new urbanist development, which is often sort of hailed as like the thing that kicked off new urbanism, you know, this movement of building towns in this new way, which is actually more of a reference to a historical way of building that never quite existed in that exact way. And I think back to a few years ago, you and I went and walked around in the Wheeler District in OKC, which I will say is a really cool neighborhood that I'm actually pretty interested in the development of and following along with, especially because it is, you know, close to downtown. It's one of the closest new urbanist developments to a downtown of a city. But it, I think we both caught onto this thing where it's like, it feels kind of manufactured. I want you to talk about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went to the Wheeler District. I mean, no hatred there. I think it's cool. I think it's great. I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting what they're doing there. But at the same time, yeah, it feels manufactured. It doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel organic. It kind of feels like a neighborhood out of like a movie set. I don't know how to describe it. But it's also strange because once you kind of leave the neighborhood, it's isolated. It's like really isolated from everything else around it. It's funny because it has like a neighborhood right next to it, and they've just completely like shut off the street connection to it. Like they're not connected to anything around them. I think there's like literally, last time I was there, was like one entrance in and out of that place. I'll just connect to my experience of living in Dallas. If you've ever been to DFW, it is a never-ending sprawl of just cities. I grew up in Allen. I'm still finding out about like cities that are here. Like there's a Southlake, Texas, which was like Allen's big rival. Recently, I learned there's a Westlake, Texas, right next to South. I didn't know that. That like blew my mind. But it's just, you know, it's like I'm finding out about all these cities because they're all so close to each other and they're all, you know, streets connect them and everything, but they just still feel so isolated from each other. I live in Uptown currently. It's very difficult for me to get anywhere around Dallas that isn't connected to like a DART station or something. If I try to go out to somewhere in, say, Plano, it's like I'll take the DART over to downtown Plano. And then beyond that, I can't do anything. I can just walk around downtown Plano. It's just like there's no connectivity within these communities. We've built all these suburban cities, but they're all still so disconnected from each other. None of them talk to each other. And I think that Wheeler District is that on like a smaller scale. It's a great community. It's, you know, it's got like a school, it's got a grocery store, it's got all that stuff. But then again, it's like, I don't see somebody that is not rich living there. And it just kind of feels like we have enough money to make this small community for ourselves. We want everybody else to stay away from us. That's how.
Yeah,
I
again, no shade at all to the Wheeler District. If you are on the development team, I do want to interview you eventually for one of these. but also, it's like Donald McDonald said, that's a space for a certain person. That can't be everywhere for everyone. There's a lot of different needs and different communities that all need to be able to coexist and connect with each other.
A lot of people don't want to be connected to somebody else. They want to be kind of private and kept away from other people. And I think there's a place for that. But then again, I mean, if that's all we're building is these disconnected communities from each other, it feels like there is no say in the way that you live, because a lot of these communities that are walkable, you're able to live and work in, are what is referred to as the 15-minute city. They're highly sought after, hot commodities within our market, and they're getting super expensive, and the vast majority of people just cannot afford to live in those. I mean, outside Toronto, there is this a suburb that is that. It's a great walkable community. It's got great public transit, everything that you would want to live in if that was something that you were looking for. But it's such a rare thing around there and around a lot of the US and Canada that it's just so expensive. And good luck finding a place that's within reason.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of affordability,
I was also curious to talk to you about some of your thoughts on homelessness, because you talked about housing as a right. Yeah. And I'm curious how you think we get to that point where everybody has access to a home.
Well, you know, you can look at countries like Sweden and Holland and these different countries. They solved the problem. They put the money in there. It's just all about money. And we spend a lot of money on different things. And billions of dollars, and we print money. There's just a lot of things we do. We could start doing it with tiny houses or something, just areas where it can get in and get help set up. So you deal with the mental problems that come with it, drugs and things like that. So, but in our society, we've never really done that. You know, we let the, when I was a student in New York at Columbia, I remember going down the Bowery and there were homeless people like laid up like cordwood at night trying to stay warm together, sleeping. There are hundreds of them. And so America's always been like that, but it doesn't have to be that way. And you go to these other countries and you don't see it. And it's minimal if it, you see it at all. And so there's lots of lessons we can learn. But I think in the United States, and I don't want to be a downer at all, but it's just that's the way it is. And so when you if you put money in some of those, like we can put $1 trillion in the armaments world and then these 10,000 homeless people in California land under the freeways or in tents and things like that. So I'm just saying there's ways to begin it. And I started looking at it way back in the 80s, I guess, and I did a thing called a city sleeper to show that, you know, you can do something to start the process. And then the idea is I did something to make life more humane, you know. And so I'm just saying that. And in Oklahoma, you've got people there that are homeless. I remember getting letters from some veterans and people that didn't have any money anymore and they're homeless. And that's when I did the City Sleeper, made Time Magazine and a few others. And because of that, I got all called, got 200 and some letters from all over the United States of how desperate some people were. And it's those kind of things that it's kind of small potatoes as far as expenses go. But for some reason, our society doesn't really worry about it. They just push on and spend money on things in the trillions where maybe a few million could help out with a certain state with the homeless.
I thought it was interesting in the book. He said, every human being has the right to a home, not just a shelter, but a private, secure, and congenial place to live at an affordable cost, or in the case of the destitute, at no cost at all. And that was on the first page of that book. I thought it was interesting how he basically just said, yeah, we could solve homelessness if we wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, look at the amount of money that, again, this is not like a rise up type thing. This is like, this is just, you know, stating, you know, keep your eyes out. But, you know, I mean, look at the amount of money that the United States of America puts in to the U.S. military. If you took like a percent of that and put it into trying to, you know, help these people that are homeless, it would help immensely. Like it would be ridiculous how much that would help. But then again, it just comes down to money. There's no money in helping get housing for these people. I don't mean to say like these people, but for there's no money in fixing homelessness. There is none. There's none to be made. And so that's why there's not really a huge push to solve that issue. I mean, I've been, you know, looking at the news recently. There's a big push of we got a lot of homeless people in the city. We need to get them out of here. And it's more of like not helping them to get into homes, but literally get out of my city. I don't want you here anymore. Like you need to find a different place, which that's just going to create more issues and not solve anything. It's going to create a veil of, hey, we fix the problem. They're, you know, that type of thing. Any issue you may think there is, and you're wondering, why does no one fix that in our country?
Follow the money.
Follow the money and ask yourself, if they were to fix this problem, would they make any money? Look at the fact that there's no high-speed rail in the United States. It's because no one would make any money doing that. And also, you know, automobile lobbyists as well, like big one, trying to stop that. I mean, look in California, the fact that they've been trying to do high-speed rail for years, and it was found out that Elon Musk had his boring company thing, and it turned out to be a front to try and stop California high-speed rail from ever getting off the ground because he wanted all the funding for himself. So it's just things like that. It's just we have these weird, like, outside influences, people wanting to make money somehow, that just are stopping progress like this.
I would also say it's important to keep in mind in terms of homelessness, from the perspective of a developer or a landlord, just in terms of supply and demand. If you provide supply of housing for everyone, that cuts out of their profits because demand goes down. That alone is why we have that artificial scarcity, even though we don't need to.
And then look at the negative connotations of just thinking about homeless people in general. I mean, a lot of people see homeless people as individuals that can't be helped, don't want to be helped, are people that, you know, you don't want to be around. You're afraid of them. But a matter of fact is, it's just these people just need help that we can provide, we're capable of doing, we just aren't able to, or we don't have the capacity because there's just not enough, you know, funding or want or interest from the community at large to step in and help.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
So you talked about the City Sleeper and installing two of them under a bridge that got removed. I'm curious what you think it would take for sort of an organization to go about installing more of those without them getting removed.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that's a solution. I just did it to begin a process to, you know, that was the start of saying, let's do something. Something's better than nothing. And that's what I did it. I wasn't trying to set up an example for the rest of the world or the nation. I just say that I was trying to get so they could have housing. So I figured, here's the beginning. And then I designed some small houses, studio houses that are, I think, 14 feet by 17 feet with a little kitchen and shower in it, things like that. So that could be the next step. But to do that in this society is really tough. You know, there's tiny houses are getting some notoriety now. And I started that about 30 years ago before it caught on. So now it seems to be catching on in certain areas. But America's always had this problem. I remember doing some work in Poughkeepsie, New York, and I looked at the newspapers from the early 30s, and they still had the problem. So it's sort of endemic in our society. I mean, certain people have to put money aside to solve the problem, and they're not doing it. But it's not my business to get involved with that stuff. So it is what it is.
I thought it was interesting, the book he talked about, the real solution would be providing these really basic units of housing for people, you know, like the studio houses that I already mentioned. And he used the recovery effort after the San Francisco earthquake in the early 1900s of how they built on public land all of these little really basic housing units that you could then, once you got back up on your feet, if you could buy a plot of land somewhere, you could take the little house with you. And a lot of people did. And they, you know, took that and they added on to it because it was literally one room, no plumbing, anything like that. He said that's a proven solution for providing a lot of housing to a lot of people who need it. He also said there are people that are kind of choosing to live outside of the societal norms. And that's, you know, the vast minority of homeless people, but people who would not even want to live in a house if given the opportunity to. And that was where he said, no, maybe something like the city sleeper is a good idea, to just give them a dry place to sleep and then they can, you know, move on. They can be a drifter.
And I like the point that you brought up at the end where, you know, you can talk on this stuff all you want. You can conceptualize all you want. But at the end of the day, we're just talking about it. So we have no real at hand solution. But I think the concept of a starter home has kind of been lost on us. A lot of the things that I see around where I live is these really big homes for, it's like large families with these massive homes. And I think just the idea of like a little house with a couple rooms as like a starter has kind of been lost. I mean, I like the just going to the organization Strong Towns. This is less on homes and more on businesses, is the idea of the starter business, something where it's not just like your regular brick and mortar building. It's more of a really tiny little land with a roof on it that people can come in or whatever, but it's just a tiny little temporary starter business that you can kind of move into and begin working in without having to pay these crazy exorbitant, I definitely did not say that word right, rents that you're having to pay if you did move into like a regular store. But at that point, it's like you know you're just starting your business, you might not be ready for that type of place. So I think that one solution possibly is building more smaller, maybe for one or two people homes, to just get them going, get them on the road towards, okay, you know, we're starting here, let's keep going, and then we'll move on to something more permanent. Or hey, maybe we'll just stay with what we have and maybe this is good enough.
The last question I asked him was kind of just for fun, so we'll have some discussion on this.
It seems like throughout your career you've worked on a lot of bridges. I'm curious what's interesting to you about bridges and what you would say the impact of a good bridge is on its city.
Well, a lot of bridges, as you know, are branding elements for cities. Cities, you know, like you talk about the Golden Gate, you think of San Francisco, you go to New York, you go to the Brooklyn Bridge. There's just a lot of them. Canada, they have them throughout the United States. And so when I do a bridge, I have these public hearings. I go to maybe 10 to 15 public hearings. I go to the public and find out what they want in a bridge, you know, and I show them ideas and they vote on it. And so the idea is to bring them into the process. So when the bridge is done, it's something that everybody loves. I did a bridge in Portland, and that stimulated a lot of growth around the both ends of the bridge, and it's been pretty important. And then that one, I did something like, I think, 18 or 20 public hearings a number of years just to get the idea through. And it's been a huge win for the city. In fact, Obama even had it on his public works advisory journal he put out during that time, and he had the bridge in the front cover saying this is an ideal situation that should be done throughout the United States. So when you bring the public into the process, it's like doing a building for somebody, bring them in complete process, showing them alternatives. And Goff used to do that. Some of the designs he did, he might do three or four designs before one would succeed, you know. So it's sort of opening up the ideas to let the person or the group that's involved with you get involved. So that's what I've done. And the bridge I've got under construction in Miami now, the I-395, that was involved with five major public hearings with the select panels from the public and architects and engineers and that. So that's kind of part of the process. So I'm sort of saying it works at all levels.
I should mention the bridge he was talking about in Portland is the Tillicum Crossing, which is a car-free bridge that has a light rail line across it and a pedestrian and cycling path. So it's a pretty cool looking bridge. I would love to go there someday. But what are your thoughts on bridges?
I totally get the idea that bridges are a branding element. I think Dallas has a couple great bridges. You know, one of them done by Santiago Calatrava. I'm not saying I like the man, but it's a great bridge. I really like it.
I should also mention Hans Butzer designed the Skydance Bridge in OKC, which, if you go to the OKC tourism website, they have a logo that is O and then the Skydance Bridge as the K and then C. So yeah, branding element for the city.
Yeah, that's a good bridge. I've been on that bridge. That's a great bridge.
Good bridge.
That's a good iconic bridge. So no, I get the branding idea.
And I think that's great. And I think it does bring another point of, you know, we're designers. You know, we have a knowledge of looking at the world in a different way than a lot of people do, just because that's what we've been trained to do, you know, college and our jobs and everything like that. And also what we decide to do in our personal lives as well with our creative hobbies. But at the end of the day, it is the people that live in these places that we're trying to create something that they actually like, something they want to use and enjoy, and something they're going to look at in 50 years, 100 years, and be like, that's a great building or bridge or something else, and I really like it.
Yeah, I would say that's a good conclusion.
Is there anywhere that you'd like to direct people who are interested in learning more about your work?
I mean, I've done enough books. They could, you know, go to the internet, go to eBay or something, and just buy some used books. There's a bunch of it out there. Yeah. So
thank you very much for talking to me and making the time and out of your busy schedule.
Yeah, if you need anything else, let me know. Okay.
Riley, thank you very much for joining me and talking about Donald McDonald with me.
You're welcome. It's been so fun. Just take everything I say with a grain of sand.
Yeah, that's none of our views are official views of Donald McDonald. I should be clear. And also, if you work at the Wheeler District, I do want to talk to you.
I think it's great. I think it's a great place to live. I just think it could be better.
Obviously, big thank you as well to Donald McDonald, because it was kind of an honor to get to talk to him, somebody that I have heard a lot about over the years, but I never thought I would be interviewing him.
Thanks, Donald.
Hey, it's me, Kyler. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to give the show a like, rating, subscription, or whatever kind of nice feedback you can provide on whatever platform you're watching or listening from. If you'd like to join our community to stay up to date or to discuss anything you heard in today's show, consider joining the Aringo Urbanism Discord server. And finally, if you'd like to support the work of Aringo Urbanism directly, you can do so over on Patreon. Until next time.